The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Warren Keyes, and I'll be reading Universal Reality, written by Michael Allen Lane. Yovak leaned back in his chair. The coding changes were complete, the beta testing had detected no faults, and with this one last keystroke, implementation would begin. It was a drastic change to the software, but it would prove the versatility of the test subjects. He stretched his 24 arms, wiggling the 12 fingers on each, and pressed the button. Cesurak noticed and walked over. "You look happy. You implemented the new changes?" Cesurak was the coding group's senior reality design engineer. Yovak retracted his arms quickly. He tended to keep his head down and to himself.
"Yes, the inhabitants won't know what hit them."
They were becoming complacent. Cesurak leaned down and plugged into the artificial universe. "Ah, they have sensed the change." Yovak nodded. "I made it apparent that their new leader was not selected properly. Already, there is tension." The group leader laughed softly. "Excellent work, Yovak. If this goes as expected, I have no doubt that you will be promoted to grade 4. Yovak glowed with pleasure.
"Thank you, group leader."
Grade 4. His broodmate, Flareol, would be greatly pleased. It had been her suggestion not to hide the rise of a dictator. Not an easy thing to accomplish within the parameters of the software's dictates. An entirely separate subroutine modifying many of the basic tenets of the original program. Once complete, though, it allowed the primary government's leadership to be taken by illegal means. It was a masterstroke. Group leader Cesurak was focusing on the brewing conflicts. The reality's governments had become too predictable. The number of test subjects was becoming too large for the software to manage. Yovak nodded.
"As we speak, group leader, the war tensions of even the most passive of the reality's inhabitants are climbing to fever pitch."
"Excellent. Far better than Feldknapp's economic disaster."
"Agreed."
Yovak felt sorry for his co-worker, but he had warned Feldknapp that the inhabitants were too adaptable to let a banking collapse lead to a war. Group leader Cesurak disconnected from the reality and nodded once.
"Inform me once the population is reduced to a third. I shall be attending the director's luncheon."
Yovak bowed and genuflected with the proper respect. Inside, he was jumping up and down with delight. It had been hard work, but if the group leader was pleased, then all the long hours had been worth it. As Cesurak floated away, Yovak returned his attention to the turmoil he had created. He smiled, the cilia on his abdomen vibrating and glowing with chartreuse delight. The major power's government leader was behaving as planned. The ill-conceived and irrational policies were proving divisive, polarizing the populace, and making conflict inevitable. One of the secondary powers was already making moves that would likely escalate into a serious conflict. Yovak was hoping for an escalation into a nuclear engagement between the major powers. "Impatient as always," he could hear his broodmate saying. Yovak nodded to himself, agreeing with her, but it was the fastest way to the desired results. and his promotion.
This is Dan Oliver reading It Will Be Under the Next Stone by Jennifer Linnea. She is the best. Not only can she overhear a conversation between spirits in a gurgling brook, or overturn those rare rocks with gin correspondence carved on the bottom, she also catches wisps of stories from the gods themselves. Songs as old as time, with messages so eternal they are as relevant today as 100,000 years ago. I met her years ago in a circle for seers that used to meet in town, back when I was entertaining the notion of going into that business myself. She loves her job and allows hardly anything else to enter her life. Her name is Gwyneth. My name is Hannah, and I'm recently deaf. I remember the sound of the desert wind through the acacia trees, but I can no longer hear it. However, I know they have been talking about me. So I wrote her, and she came. She's kneeling beside the stone wall that bounds my yard, ear to the ground, hand on an unearthed tree root. Her hair is brown, shot with gray. I can tell from how thin she is that she forgets to eat sometimes. I bring her mesquite honey and crackers on a tray and place them on the ground beside her. She does not look up, but I did not expect her to. I pluck a pebble off the ground and inspect its bottom, cool where it was touching the ground. No message there. The trees know something about me that I don't know. That I am a changeling, or the chosen one of an old prophecy, or that there is gold buried beneath my house. Before, when I could hear, I heard them whispering about me, but I could never make out the words. Gwyneth rises and walks out through the rusty gate into the desert which brushes up against my property. No matter that on either side of the wall it looks mostly the same, in here is the yard, out there is the desert. I watch as she wanders down to the dry creek bed. Lots of acacias down there. She's listening very intently to something. Her brow furrows in concentration. It's about 10 in the morning. Already the sun has washed the color out of everything, and the heat has weight. If Gwen forgets to drink, it won't be very good for her. So I go into the house and draw water from the tap into a clear glass. I walk down to the dry creek bed and hand it to her. She holds the cup to her ear. Then she drinks. What does well water have to say to her, I wonder? I pick up a fist-sized rock and study the bottom. Gwen stays out all day. I bring her several more glasses of water and some dried figs, but she never once talks to me, which is good, because I don't read lips very well yet. The sun is setting red behind the bluff when she returns. I've lined a bunch of stones on the windowsill, and I'm half staring at them and half staring out the window, and it startles me having her appear before me like that. She hands me a folded piece of paper, and I unfold it right away and read it. It says, "A djinn is in love with you. He stole your hearing because the acacias make no secret of their disapproval of him and all his kind. But 1,000 years ago, before you were born, he carved a message for you on the bottom of a stone. When you find it, follow its instructions until you meet him." I look into her face, and I'm searching for mockery, the intimation of a joke, but I see none. I reach out my hands to take hers, wanting comfort, but she pulls away. So I reach for my wallet instead. I pull out a stack of 20s and hand them to her. She counts them and nods, satisfied. I walk her to the door, then out through the gate to her powder blue pickup truck parked at the end of the driveway. I hope she'll stop, lean against her truck, and write something else, that she's sorry, that she understands how upset I must be, that she'll tell me how I'm supposed to deal with knowing I've lost the sound of birdsong over an attempt to control my heart. Instead, she gets in the truck. Dust billows up in plumes as she drives away, and I stare at it for patterns. but it's getting too dark to see. Or maybe there's just nothing there. I refold the note and tuck it into my jeans pocket. As I walk slowly back to the house, the motion-sensing floodlights kick on. I remember the crackers and honey and go to retrieve the tray, but the ants have gotten to it, so I let it be. The whole time, slow fury builds in me. The next day, I walk down to the acacia trees. I watch their leaves dance in the wind. I pick up a stone by habit, then throw it as hard as I can without turning it over. I jam my hands deep into my pockets. He took something that was precious from me. He shall take nothing else.
I'm Eric Hale, and I'll be reading Sophisticated by Brendan T. Stallings. Vander raced across the college campus, dodging people left and right in hopes of making it to class before they locked the doors. Rounding the last corner, he narrowly avoided a faculty member with a large stack of books. Vander chanced a quick look back to make sure the professor was all right, and as he did so, crashed into something, ricocheting backward and landing hard on the ground. Looking up, he discovered that he had apparently run into, and also knocked down, the most attractive girl he had ever seen. But she seemed to have popped up out of nowhere. Feeling quite foolish, he quickly stood and offered her his hand. "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry," he said, mentally cursing his first impression. She looked up at him and actually smiled. "At him." "Don't worry about it. I'm pretty durable," she said, taking his hand. She looked at him and cocked her head. "Don't I know you? You're in my English class, right?" He had no idea. There were over 700 people in that class. "Yeah, that's right," he guessed. "I'm Vander," he said, briefly forgetting his name. "Sam. It's short for Samantha, just like me," she joked, looking up at him. Vander chuckled awkwardly. He had a thing for humor and girls with boy names. This could be dangerous. "Where were you going in such a hurry?" she asked. Vander checked his watch. He was now late. "Apparently nowhere. I'm late for class." Sam checked her phone. "Hey, me too. Want to grab a drink?" "A drink? Sure." Vander couldn't believe his luck. "I probably owe you one for running into you." "And for making you late?" "Fine. Two drinks. You talked me into it." Sam smiled and took his hand as they headed off. At the bar, they talked for hours. Vander couldn't believe how much they had in common. She kept starting sentences with, "Hey, do you like?" only to find out it was one of Vander's favorite things. Art, entertainment, philosophy, snacks, it was almost like she already knew him. He immediately fell for her. Sam was effortlessly beautiful with a perfect smile and somehow reminded him simultaneously of every girl he'd ever lived near. They spent the entire weekend together, visiting museums, going to dinner, and seeing movies. Sunday night, they were sitting on Vander's bed watching a TV show they both loved when Sam suddenly leaned over and kissed him. It was a particularly good kiss. Swelling music played in Vander's head as he quickly took a mental snapshot of the happiest moment of his life. He still couldn't believe that he had literally run headfirst into the best thing that had ever happened to him. Where had she come from? "Vander," she said, "it's hard to believe that we only met because you were late. Can I tell you something?" She leaned in closer, whispering, "Did you know that you can get great deals on alarm clocks at megadeals.com? In fact, you can save up to 50% on all retail purchases. Just click subscribe to..." His heart sank as her words and realization washed over him. He couldn't believe it. Not again, he thought. Feeling the deep shame of the proverbial sucker, he started to cry softly. "Eye irritation?" she asked rhetorically. "Try new." He reached up and carefully tucked her hair behind her left ear, revealing a small X. "Goodbye, Sam," he whispered. "Going somewhere," she replied. "We've got great deals on planes." He pressed the X. Her eyes turned black, and she fell into his lap, completely limp. He cradled her body as the tears continued down his cheeks. These ads were getting really sophisticated.
My name is Keith Kennel, and I'm reading Wing Day by Mary E. Loud. Liele had never been to a Wing Day party, much less thrown one herself. The butterfly-like alien crossed her uppermost pair of fuzzy exoskeletal arms and watched her clone daughter scurry around their quarters, excited, sugar-crazed, and impatient for the guests to arrive. Amelie flapped her new wings, throwing herself into the air. She bounced off the ceiling and landed awkwardly on newly long, spindly legs. A month ago, Amelie had been a pudgy green caterpillar babe. At least Liele had thought of her as a babe, even though she was nearly 10 years old. "When do my friends get here?" Amelie fluted, stumbling over the words with her unfamiliar mouth parts, her long proboscis unfurled and recurled, nearly tangling in her mandibles. "Soon," Liele answered, rearranging the table of refreshments yet again. She hated throwing parties, never knowing which friends would come, which would cancel at the last minute, when exactly they'd arrive, or if they'd all get along. She might be a lepidarian, a type of sentient butterfly, but she was not a social butterfly. The door chimed, and Amelie flapped over to answer it, tumbling and tripping along the way. Her wings were beautiful, stained-glass windows come to life, but they were ungainly and made her clumsy in the space station's gravity. Amelie opened the door, and the human woman on the other side gasped. She put her hand to her mouth, and sparkles of tears sprang to her eyes. "You look just like your mother did before she replaced her wings." "Of course she does," Liele fluted. "She hatched from an unfertilized egg. She might as well be my clone. You know that." "I know," Amy said. "A grandmother can still be surprised by how beautiful her granddaughter is." Amy held her two fleshy arms out, and Amelie folded her four exoskeletal arms around her in a gentle embrace. Liele knew that Amelie looked more like her than her adopted human mother, Amy, but it was still her identical daughter who looked strange to Liele. Having been raised on a human space station after being rescued from a wrecked ship by a human woman, Liele had spent far more of her life looking at humans than her own species. In fact, until Amelie had emerged from her chrysalis a few days ago, Liele had never seen an adult of her species except an infocast from a faraway home world where she'd never visited, or in a mirror. "What can I do to help?" Amy asked. "I think we're all set up," Liele touched the edges of various bowls on the refreshment table nervously with each of her four taloned hands. Amy stepped close to her daughter and laid a fleshy hand on one of Liele's mechanical wings. "I'm sorry you never had a Wing Day party," she said. "I didn't know." "Neither did I," Liele fluted. She didn't blame her mother. Amy had done her best raising an alien child. And honestly, although Liele looked nothing like other humans, she felt more like a human than a lepidarian. She was trying to do better for her daughter, trying to give Amelie some of the things she'd missed out on, save Amelie from some of the trouble she'd experienced. The door chimed again. This time, when Amelie opened it, a crowd of children poured in, each of them a different species, all of them Amelie's friends, and each of them thrilled to see how she'd metamorphosed over the last month. "What was it like being in a cocoon?" an avian boy chirped. "Was it dark and quiet?" a reptilian girl hissed. "Peaceful?" "It wasn't a cocoon," Amelie fluted, flapping her wings so vigorously she rose into the air, tilted, lost balance, and crashed down again. "It was a chrysalis hanging from the ceiling, and when my head split open..." "What?" the avian squawked. "My head split open." It took a while for Amelie to explain her words to her crowd of friends. Liele could sympathize with their horror and confusion. She remembered the metamorphosis happening to herself and had still been terrified as she watched it begin with her own daughter. Amelie's adorable caterpillar face had split down the middle, crumpled up, and been replaced by a smooth crystalline shell of a chrysalis underneath. Liele couldn't even fathom how her human mother had handled watching that happen to her. Even so, Amelie's chrysalis had been the most beautiful thing Liele had ever seen. Under the translucent shell, the lines of Amelie's caterpillar body had transformed. Green curves stretched into blue arcs, growing longer, narrower, more aristocratic, and serious over the weeks. Finger-like mouth parts coalesced into a swooping proboscis, In that sleep of metamorphosis, blue veins pulsed and purple wet wings developed from tiny buds to crammed folds, filling the inside of the chrysalis so tightly, so very tightly, it had had to burst open. Liele had felt tentative and unsure at first when Amle had emerged in her adult form. She looked so different. Liele had felt shy with her own daughter, a being who shared her entire genetic code and had spent every day with her for 10 years, ever since hatching from an unfertilized yellow egg. "Wait," the reptilian girl hissed, breaking Liele from her reverie. "How did you hang from the ceiling? Where's there a hook up there or something?" The reptilian girl craned her neck, looking at every corner of the ceiling, forked tongue flicking. "Of course not," Amle fluted. "I glued my feet to the ceiling with silk spit from the glands of my mouth." "Ew!" all the alien children cried in chorus. "Now I'm not hungry for any of these snacks," the avian boy complained, although he still took a wing handful of toasted berry buds. Liele waited until all the guests had arrived and the snacks were nearly demolished before pulling her daughter aside and saying, "I think it's time." Amle flapped her wings and clapped four talon hands eagerly, practically vibrating with excitement. She had no reason not to be excited. She'd known all along that the wings she'd grow were vestigial and would need to be removed. Unlike Liele, she wouldn't suffer through years of clumsiness, knocking down everything around herself and slow, growing aches as the two large wings messed up all the muscles in her back. This was a good thing. This was what Amy would have done for Liele if she'd known, if she'd been able to locate the Lepidopter in home world and get any basic information about her daughter. Instead, she'd muddled through, and it had never occurred to her that Lepidopterans removed their wings shortly after growing them. Even so, Liele had lived on Crossroads Station with her natural biological wings for years, being constantly praised by humans and other aliens for their beauty. She'd learned to value them for the way they turned her into a work of art that turned every human's head. And yet, she'd been relieved when she'd learned they could be removed, that it was normal for them to be removed. By then, Liele had been so used to her wings that she'd commissioned a much smaller, more useful mechanical pair to replace them. But Amle didn't even want those. She'd read all the infocasts from their home world and had definitely declared she was going to be a normal, wingless Lepidopteran. Amle handed her mother the knife. With infinite care, Liele pressed the metal blade to Amle's back where the soft wing membrane met the hard exoskeleton. Amy turned away. Liele pressed down with the knife and sliced the first wing off in one smooth cut. The membrane parted on the knife as easily as warm butter. The wing fell to the floor. The stained glass window had melted. Amle laughed. "I'm lopsided now." All her friends laughed with her. Liele curled her proboscis tightly. It was hard to cut so much beauty away from her daughter, but she knew it shouldn't be. Her daughter was wiser and better informed than she'd been. If she'd been raised in her own culture, this would be a joyous occasion for her, too, instead of a bittersweet one. "Cut the other one! Cut the other one!" Amle led the other children in a chant. Liele's hand talon shook, holding the knife. She didn't know if she could do it again. A fleshy human hand steadied Liele's talon, and the Lepidopteran looked up to see the face of her mother. "Let me," Amy said. "I should have done this for you. Let me be a part of doing it for your daughter." "Thank you," Liele fluted, handing over the knife. She stepped back to watch. Amy cut off Amle's second wing, and it fell discarded to the floor. All the children cheered and Amle pirouetted, spindly exoskeletal arms waving like she was leading a choir.
I'm Kurt Benrood. I'm reading This is Telepathy by Megan Newman. Sarah sticks the needle in her arm and falls backwards, feeling the pain of the wound and the soft sheets of her bed. It doesn't hit her immediately. Several minutes pass as the nanites travel through her bloodstream and latch onto her brain. To Sarah, those minutes last an eternity. Each time she injects, the wait feels longer than the time before. She craves the connection to be initiated, to be alive with the world again. The nanites will attach to the neurons in her brain and enable a wireless data connection. The interpreter software that she installed months earlier render the web pages as something that can be interacted with by thought alone. When her connection goes live this time, the banging on her bedroom door starts. 100 web pages appear in her mind. Her session from last time restored, Twitter feeds, Facebook statuses, and 1,000 Instagram photos flood into view. She consumes them hungrily as the banging on the door grows louder. "This is telepathy," she whispers as the thoughts of thousands fill her mind. Those that also injected update their statuses with their thoughts, and Sarah knows them as they know her own. Injecting is illegal, but that's rarely enforced. Sarah thinks the illegality of it is pointless. It is a precautionary measure since the long-term effects are unknown. There have been a few cases of the injected wandering outside under the influence and causing accidents. Sarah knows better. She locks herself in her room where she lies in bed, enjoying her connection to the world. Trisha's voice now accompanies the banging. She yells something, but it's too difficult for Sarah to make sense of it. The interpretation of data consumes too much of Sarah's mind. She can stop and listen, but she needs to take advantage of her time. The injection lasts only a few hours. After that, the nanites will deteriorate. Someday, it will last forever, Sarah thinks between page loads. Then she will inject for the last time. She imagines a world of telepaths. Beneath Trisha's voice, a baby cries. The sound reminds Sarah that she needed to upload photos of Taylor. His third birthday party was last week, and Sarah has pictures of it on her phone. She connects to the phone and uploads the pictures to her accounts. A tsunami of likes and compliments rush over her. Her body convulses and her head swims. She's never had so many people connected to her at once. She smiles, and tears of joy leak from her eyes. "You're supposed to watch Taylor tonight. I have to go to work," Trisha says. Sarah hears this, but finds little meaning in it. "I can't be late again." Sarah tags Trisha in the photos. Someone comments that they are such a cute couple. What a beautiful baby they have. Three people like that comment. Outside the bedroom, Trisha stops banging. Sarah hears Trisha's footsteps moving away from the door. "I'm taking Taylor with me," Trisha says. Sarah will try to remember Trisha's words for later, after the nanites die. For now, she wants to stay connected to her friends, to the world. She updates her status to say she is so lucky to have such wonderful friends and family. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.